With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand. And donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. A storm of misinformation is coming. Malicious interference, the poisoning of our democratic processes, foreign operators. The only question is, will we be ready? That's not a teaser for a bad Netflix show. That is an editorial from last week's Globe and Mail. It was written, for some reason, by Eric Jardine, assistant professor at Virginia Tech, trying to scare the pants off Canadians about what he thinks is likely to happen in our next election. And he's not alone. Our intelligence agencies have been ringing alarm bells about the fake news, foreign bots, hateful trolls, lions and tigers and bears to come. And CSIS now has $750 million in new funding from the federal government in part to fight this. Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale has been waving his club at Facebook, threatening that if they don't clean up their act themselves, government will belly up and do it for them. Democratic Institutions Minister Karina Gould says that she is not satisfied that Facebook and others are taking our democracy seriously enough and that all options are on the table in terms of stepping in and regulating them. What a difference a couple of years make.
I am absolutely delighted to see Facebook taking a step in the right direction today in addressing the challenges of the digital era and the continued protection of our democratic process.
That was Democratic Institutions Minister Karina Gould in 2017 expressing her delight that Facebook was protecting Canada's democratic institutions. She said that as Facebook's guest at an election integrity initiative launched by Facebook. Her host was Kevin Chan, Facebook's Canada policy guy, who had a different job years before that. He used to be a top Liberal Party guy. He was Michael Ignatieff's policy guy. So those are some memories back from when Facebook and Justin Trudeau's Liberals were friends, when it was politically convenient for Justin Trudeau to look like a young, tech-forward friend to Silicon Valley. But today it's politically convenient for Justin Trudeau's Liberals to be the sunny alternative to trolls and bots and bears, oh my. Today-ish, it was politically convenient for Michael Wernick, the former clerk of the Privy Council, to imperiously decry the, quote, vomitorium of social media as he bloviated and obfuscated his role in the SNC scandal, before he ultimately admitted that he has lost any semblance of nonpartisan impartiality and pissed off. Today, a narrative is being constructed in anticipation of the coming election that Justin stands with Real News and Andrew stands with Pepe. So you will forgive me if I am a little bit skeptical about the government's newfound enthusiasm for regulating Facebook. even though that's exactly what I suggested they should be doing about a year ago. You know what? I have complicated feelings about this. I'm actually not sure what I think they should do. I don't have the data. I don't know what other countries have done. I don't know what has worked, what is possible, and what would just be a horrible intrusion into everybody's free expression, which, you know, among other effects, might cost me my livelihood. But Natasha Tusakov knows. She wrote the book on this, Choke Points, Global Private Regulation on the Internet. She is an assistant professor of criminology at York University. And with a topic as complicated as this, with so many roads ahead and so little information about how it ends, you would not expect us to actually arrive at a solution. But we do. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Matthew Adams, Jeremy Kaplan, Emily O'Rourke, Nicholas Kaiser, Ali Burcock, Colin McRae, Alexander Offord, and Danny.
My name is Danny. I'm a music maker and educational assistant in Winnipeg. I support Canada Land because it's educative and engaging, and in a format that I appreciate. I place a lot of trust in everything I hear on Canada Land, because your only apparent loyalty is to quality journalism.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Hi, Natasha.
Hi.
Are we in the midst of a moral panic?
That's a good point. I think... Certainly, we could see some elements of moral panic, but I think we have to remember that we have seen a big shift since 2016. So Cambridge Analytica, Facebook's involvement in sharing, giving, allowing users' data to be used in ways that your users didn't know about, Facebook being found to be rather careless with users' data, Facebook being found by the United Nations to be involved in fomenting a genocide in Myanmar. So we have some very serious situation in regards to social media, and Facebook is the most prominent bad actor. So I think a number of countries that have elections coming up or have recently had elections have been very concerned. Will social media be involved in kind of facilitating electoral interference? How do we stem the bad ads? We saw that in the U.S. presidential election in 2016. We saw that in the Brexit referendum. And I think Canadian politicians and policymakers are rightly concerned. But what steps are best to address that? That's the big question.
How much of this is happening in Canada? I mean, I noticed this in the Shattered Mirror report when Ed Greenspan was suggesting why we needed to bail out the newspapers. And I think that the term fake news was used over a dozen times in a country where, like, this is what we do here is keep track of Canadian news. I'm aware of like two or three stories that were like legitimately fake news in that absolutely manufactured initial sense, as Craig Silverman wrote about it for BuzzFeed, of, you know, the Pope has endorsed Donald Trump, kind of just total fabrication, misleading people for an electoral outcome. There's bad news in Canada, but the idea that we would put our newspapers on permanent government dependence based on this scourge of fake news in Canada, I don't see any. I think it's possible to be incredibly critical of all of Facebook's evils. Like, really, like they really have misled us. They've shown such little accountability, but also to be skeptical as to whether or not, like, how big of a problem is this in Canada really? And maybe as an academic, like, is that something that you can quantify? Do we know how big a problem Facebook has been in Canada?
No. Certainly, I'm not aware of any studies in that area. We have some good research coming out from media and communication scholars in Canada, people like Taylor Owen, Dwayne Winsek. But I think, you know, what the government is looking at more broadly is bigger than the issue of fake news. It's for an election, when you have a lot of political ads, how do you manage that? So are there actors funding political advertisements that are in violation of Canadian law? How do we make sure that social media platforms do have some regulation in that way? We have certain regulations for radios and televisions to monitor and to track who pays for political ads and to make sure that's according to Canadian law. So social media platforms, the government would argue, rightly so, should follow some kinds of rules as well. I think there is a lot of concern. Some of it may be misfounded, but they're looking at the United States and the United Kingdom, as well as, you know, some other elections around the world, as what to avoid.
You know, you look at the United States and you look at what's happening in the UK, and I wonder if there isn't something happening where people don't want to accept that these societies are divided, that people are speaking from very different perspectives, and they have legitimate points of conflict with each other where they just don't see eye to eye. And instead, our focus goes to, okay, yes, there are foreign actors who will come and identify those points of conflict between us and try to drive a wedge between us. But you can't do that if they don't already exist. There's almost like a wish. What if we're not as divided as Facebook makes us look like? What if this is all some quirk of some Russian troll farm and we can just legislate them out of existence? I don't dispute that these troll farms exist. And, you know, like, I think that maybe their influence has been overblown. I kind of feel like there's always been some interference by foreign actors in the democratic process. And we do have laws about that. And a lot of this is just stemming from an idea that we can kind of just like click our heels together and wake up from this nightmare and be friends again. Whereas it seems kind of like an Occam's razor obviosity to me that we're able to voice our opinions in a way that we weren't before. We were able to mobilize and form groups together. We were able to be nasty to each other in ways that we weren't before. And surprise, 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 democracy can be ugly. Freedom of speech can be ugly. We're fighting with each other. It's not a huge shocker. You know, are we just blaming Facebook and trolls for just human behavior?
I think we're in a period right now of a seismic political and social shift in terms of how we regard social media platforms. Since 2016, I think rightly so, there's been political and public and academic attention and some very good media attention on the systemic problems of social media. So there's been a lot more emphasis on their business models, right? This is a surveillance-based business model. They make money by personalized advertisements, which means a massive data-intensive business model. You have to collect a lot of data, store a lot of data, analyze a lot of data to be able to sell people personal ads. And these are also business models that are fueled on viral clicks. So whether that is a great story, you know, a beautiful story about a kitten, a heartwarming story about puppies, or whether it's really dark conspiracy theories about certain people being behind the Notre Dame Cathedral fire. So in some cases, if we look at the structural problems of this, an ad-based, surveillance-based business model where algorithms fuel some of our worst intentions, our worst beliefs, that's really something where our attention should be focused. So some of the things we're seeing, like you mentioned, we're seeing people capitalize on division, where some people are doing that for profit. They're creating fake news stories about, say, Canada's immigration system. Mm-hmm. They're driving people towards those stories, and they're making money off of it. What I'd be concerned about is organized efforts by people outside of Canada or inside of Canada to peddle deliberately fake information in order to stir up violence, to stir up hatred against other groups. There's always going to be people putting their spin on a policy, mm-hmm. and that's what you'd expect in a democracy, especially during a heated election. I think it's organized efforts to entrench racism, prejudice ideas, and to try and make money off it. I think that's what's most concerning.
It's very concerning, and I think that it's something that we endeavor to kind of expose all the time. You say it's a surveillance-based business model. It's also an ignorance-based business model. People didn't know what they were getting into. It feels like people are finally waking up to that. And there is a dialogue finally with Facebook where the public is saying, hey, you've built a divisiveness engine. You've built a hate engine. We don't want to use this if it's going to be that way. And then Facebook responds, you know, and makes changes to their product. Isn't that the way that this should reform?
First of all, we're in a situation of monopolies, right? There isn't really a viable alternative for Facebook. You can go to LinkedIn, but it's not the same type of social media. Instagram's owned by Facebook, so there aren't a lot of alternatives. Part of the problem, too, has been these companies gobble up new companies as soon as they emerge. And a challenge is, too, there's been a lot of pressure on people to learn about their privacy. There's been a lot of emphasis. You as an individual are responsibilized. You've got to read your terms of service agreement. You've got to do that every time it changes. Could be weekly, could be monthly. You've got to do it for all 50 apps and services that you subscribe to. That's a lot of responsibility for people. And there's been really great marketing research, consumer behavior research saying, we don't know what we've signed up to. We don't know these terms of service. We don't fully read them. It's too much. And the other point is these companies, they have tremendous latitude in the rules that they make. Right? They can change them at any time. And we can sign up under one terms of service. Say we like how Instagram treats, say, erotica or health images. And then suddenly Instagram can change this terms of service and destroy our entire catalog of art, our business. So there's been some really terrible stories of people who sell erotic content and their entire business model is based on, you know, advertising through Instagram. Instagram changes its terms of service and people are left with nothing. And so I think it's the capriciousness, the arbitrariness, the way these companies can change their terms of service that's really concerning. So this is why myself and my co-author, Blaine Haggart from Brock University, are really saying, what's the role for the state? And not just in, you know, monitoring everything, but especially in monitoring and controlling violent hate speech, for the role of the state in getting rid of the worst excesses of the illegal content we're seeing online.
And what's your conclusion? What is the role for the, what can the government do about all this stuff?
Well, this is the question, but definitely governments can legislate. So we've been in a situation for the past 30 years where we've talked about free market, where we've talked about if you don't like it, exit, voice and exit. So it's the power of consumers to leave a bad business and to go somewhere else. But we're in a situation now where some of these companies are so big and there's no alternatives, we can't leave. We've also been in a situation where we thought if you shame the company, if you complain to Facebook and say, I don't like the fact that you let white supremacists on, I don't like the fact that you allow violent trolling behavior, that the company would respond. And we've seen Facebook has been really terrible about that. They've not been responsive. If you complain, even if thousands of people complain, Facebook can be really slow to take down terrible toxic content, but they can be really fast about taking down an image of a woman breastfeeding because they don't like female nipples. So I think some of these things that we've been told that, you know, if you're a good consumer, a responsible consumer, if you act against the company and bring forward your concerns, the company will change. And Facebook just hasn't. And we're in a situation now where Facebook has been found by the UN to be responsible for facilitating genocide.
Yeah. If we're talking about what government can do, are there not already a ton of laws that we have that government just isn't using? We have anti-hate speech laws. There's stuff on Facebook every second that violates them. We have anti-harassment laws. We have laws against death threats. We do have laws against foreign actors trying to influence, you know, our election laws are pretty robust, as I understand them. We have libel laws that are not really enforced. We have taxation that doesn't seem to apply to these companies. I mean, wouldn't the obvious place to start just be asking that they abide by the same rules as like any other company?
We've got an enforcement problem, definitely. Is this a resourcing problem? Is it a problem where it's a jurisdictional problem? So definitely a problem with enforcement. And we do have a problem where We're not in the United States, right? We're a small, wealthy industrial country, but we're not a very large market. And what kind of effect can we have on U.S.-based tech giants that really prefer a U.S. regulatory framework? So the Privacy Commissioner of Canada has before called out the social media giants and to say, listen, you have to abide by Canadian privacy laws. And in the past, that response has been pretty dismissive. It's been, we're based in the United States, we follow U.S. laws. And part of this is for the government to take this seriously, right? To call out, to demand, to pass new rules, to actually enforce existing rules for these companies to actually follow the rules in Canada.
I think, you know, people who listen to the show regularly who hear me be very critical about these companies and how slow they are to respond to hate and harassment might be surprised to hear me seemingly defending them. I don't feel defensive of these companies, but I do feel concerned about government getting involved in a lot of the ways that have been suggested. I want to try to explore why. I almost feel like if we look to these companies and say, you are the de facto place where conversation takes place, that's like handing them way too much. That's accepting that they've won a battle that, like, you know, they're not a public park. They're a shopping mall. When you lean on a Google about taking money from malicious foreign actors to influence our election, what did they do? They said, okay, we're not going to do political ads at all. Mm-hmm. What happened when Facebook got embarrassed for all the fake news and allowing all this divisive content? They downgraded all news. No law against that. You become too much of a problem. And this place that we've essentially handed the keys and saying you are the place where public discourse happens is, public discourse has gotten too complicated. It's not profitable. Policing this is more expensive than it's worth. So we'll just serve more cat videos.
It's a dangerous concession if we just accept that, right? So Google may decide, okay, fine, for the 2019 election, they're not going to show any election ads. I think that's a terrible problem. And I think that's an indication of how little they take their corporate social responsibility in Canada. It cannot be that difficult to monitor effectively political advertising. So they've decided that Canada simply isn't worth it. But then I think we can take a critical look at how else Google operates in Canada. I mean, we're sitting in Toronto. We have Sidewalk Labs proposing to have a smart city. Sidewalk Labs mm-hmm. is a sister company of Google. Maybe then we take a critical look at that and say, well, what if Sidewalk Labs does win this proposal? They do build a smart city and they decide partway through, you know what, we're not in the smart city business anymore. As these companies offer more services, as they build more infrastructure, social media infrastructure, all kinds of smart city infrastructure, I think a really critical question is what happens when they leave? Like, what happens when a city as a platform fails, when a company just says, Canada's not good for us anymore, we're going to move to Korea?
So that brings us to antitrust. I do have, I think, a legitimate fear that if we basically say you are responsible for policing the content on your network, we're opening up all kinds of issues where essentially now Facebook, which has shown no real ability to be a ethical or competent or responsible social actor, is now deciding what's hate speech and what's real news and what's fake news. I'm terrified by that. You know, this news organization exists in some liminal space where we're not the, you know, gold standard masthead of like real news. And I certainly hope we're not in the gutter of the fake news. And I do not hand authority over to some panel at Facebook or some algorithm at Facebook to make that determination of where on their spectrum we should fall. I'm much more comfortable with readers making that decision. So those anxieties aside, what we've done in the past and what governments can do, we break them up. We've done it before. We did it in the Gilded Age. We did it when the movie studios owned the theater and distribution, exhibition, creation. Movies got shittier. They locked out competitors. We broke them up. It worked pretty well. Would that not be a regulatory answer to this before we get into that policing of content?
Yeah, so this is what a number of critical communications scholars say, that before you turn to policing content, you look at the structure, you look at the behavioral issues. So definitely antitrust, Facebook owning WhatsApp, Instagram, you know, breaking those up. So this is what Senator Elizabeth Warren is proposing in the United States. If you want to be a search engine like Google, then you're also not an advertising mm-hmm. platform. I'm not a competition lawyer. I don't know exactly how these things work. I've read critiques that, of course, this would be very long, very complex, very, very expensive, and, you know, a decade-long fight. But this is what governments do. They do break up companies when they become a threat to the free market, when their negative externalities overwhelm what positives they bring. And nothing said about the tech industry that this is going to be easy or cheap. These are very difficult questions, and how we approach this is really, really serious. Now, you talked about you don't want Facebook to be a company that makes and rules about hate speech. It already is, in the worst possible way. It sets these rules privately. It enforces them secretly without accountability. And we're not really sure from moment to moment how Facebook understands hate speech or how YouTube understands violent extremism. So this is a huge problem. Another related problem is that governments around the world have been working in cooperation with these companies through voluntary agreements, so-called voluntary industry-led agreements. And what these really are is they're handshake agreements,
yeah,
where, you know, the Canadian government says, Facebook, we'd like you to do more. We're not going to pass legislation, but we're encouraging you to do more, and maybe we're holding the vague threat of legislation over you. The United Kingdom has done this. The United States has done this. And this is the worst possible way for a state to act, because as concerned as I am about states being involved in deciding what content is appropriate, if they're going to do this, I want them to do this through democratically accountable ways. I want them to put together public consultation papers. I want there to be bills that we can debate seriously, that people can bring up concerns. And then I want the legislation to be public. With my co-author, Blaine Hegart, what we've been talking about is this is the worst of both worlds. We've got secret, unaccountable industry regulation, mm-hmm, and we've got governments doing handshake deals with these big tech companies.
I mean, I think about other industries that have come under moral panic fire, be it the movie industry. Everyone's getting really scared about what's happening to the youth watching these terrible movies. They come up with the Motion Picture Ratings Board. The comic book industry, the Comic Book Code Authority, Seduction of the Innocent, kids are being corrupted by comic books. The electronic ESRB, you know, basically these industries didn't want government to get involved, so they started to police themselves and they came up with some standard. A lot of the problems that you're pointing out, terms of service that nobody reads, terms of service that change, and no consistency over what privacy regulations are. I can imagine that the industry comes up with some sort of universally shared set of guidelines and you get like a stamp of compliance. I would have to imagine that they would prefer that to government telling them what to do.
Probably. It was very interesting that 2 weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg in the Washington Post came out and said, we're now in favor of government regulation. It's been a horrible 2 years, 2.5 years for Facebook. So it's in some ways, it's not surprising that facing this year of scandals or 2 years of scandals that they're kind of saying, maybe there is a role for government regulation. Maybe we would like someone else to set these rules. So when we enforce those rules, we can at least point to a government actor and say, we're just following what we've been told to do. What some of these companies want is consistency. Different countries adopt different ideas or different conceptions of hate speech, obscenity. It can be difficult, but you're a globally operating actor. You know, if you're a billion-dollar company and you have a team of lawyers, you can adapt to a complex regulatory environment.
Can you? I mean, you say that like it's easy, but you're pointing out some of the problems here. And okay, so I think that some of their early complaints, like, oh, this is a totally new thing. It's not like publishing a newspaper or running a TV station. We have, you know, millions of bits of content and we can't possibly regulate it. But of course, they do regulate against pictures of breastfeeding and you won't find hardcore pornography on these platforms and you won't find ISIS recruitment beheading videos. Intellectual property, they've cracked down on piracy in effective ways. However, in all of these campaigns, if they miss stuff, then they look ineffective. So they go too far and a bunch of false positives happen. Vast swaths of expression get kicked off. Our democracy operates on Facebook. And if you trigger the wrong algorithm or, you know, like you're done, it will be an automated solution. You know, or if it's human powered, it will be exploitative labor, you know, Mechanical Turk type stuff. You know, the game keeps changing and it's a cat and mouse thing. We just saw it in the Alberta election. A bunch of critics of Jason Kenney and the United Conservative Party had their accounts on Twitter suspended on the eve of the election. I suspect that somebody figured out how to gamify the report abuse. And this was a measure to deal with harassment, but it became politicized. You know, political speech is free speech. I mean, that's why we have free expression in the first place. I worry about these things.
I worry about it too. So when we talk about intellectual property rights holders like Gucci, like the Motion Picture Association of America, what they want is content taken down, whether these are sales listings for counterfeit Gucci purses or whether it's the latest Avengers movie that's streaming illegally against infringement of copyright somewhere. And the idea of choke points is that there's these big companies, Google for search and advertising, PayPal, Visa, and MasterCard for finance. And if you can only remove them as actors, if they withdraw their services, then the people offering the content, the bad content, or doing the bad acts are left without advertising money, are left without money. Now, financial choke points are particularly tough because people need money, right? So if you're selling something, if you're raising donations, and suddenly Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal pull the plug, yes, you can survive on Bitcoin and a few other things, but it's really, really difficult. So intellectual property rights owners were, very innovative in this area, but it's also been used against terrorists. It's been used against child pornographers, if you pull the plug on that. And now we're seeing it being used against hate groups. White supremacist groups, PayPal is being pressured, encouraged in the United States by civil society organizations like Color of Change to just pull the plug. And while this is appealing, right, because then we're stopping violent white supremacist groups from raising money, the problem is that this is really non-transparent. And if PayPal can do this against Proud Boys, then it can also do it against Black Lives Matter activists. Part of the issue, I think, is that we assume that these companies are going to continue operating as global networks, as global actors. And maybe they don't. Maybe there are more national rules drawn. Maybe there's more regarding, operating according to Canadian laws.
Isn't that hard on the internet?
There's the technical aspect of the internet, which would not be interrupted by this. But, I mean, we know Netflix, right, has libraries all over the world. And the Canadian Netflix library is different than the U.S. Netflix library.
And I have a VPN.
You have a VPN. But none of these solutions are designed for 100% accuracy,
yeah.
Right? For Facebook, if I were on Facebook's board, I'd be concerned about getting most of the violent trolls off, getting most of the white supremacists, most of the extremists off. You're not going to get everyone, but especially if you get the groups that are organized, that are intent on causing violence, intent on hurting other people, and intent on raising money. If you get rid of those people, then you can deal with the rest.
What's interesting to me is that, community standards shift, and as these companies get bigger and more respectable, they start enforcing what they see as community standards. But the whole system of commerce online was really built for porn and for sex-related products. And it's interesting to see that some of those financial choke points turning their backs on that industry that kind of gave birth to them in the first place.
Absolutely. And part of this problem is the tech industry is extremely uncomfortable with female sexuality. So there's a lot of sex, there's a lot of female nudity that's sexualized, but when it's women selling erotica, making erotica, acting as sex workers, working as sex workers, yes, these companies take a very draconian approach. And this is something that sex workers and sex-positive sites have been decrying for years and saying, we were the forerunners, we adopted the first websites, we were promoting the first online payment systems, we are the forerunners of the internet. We've been the really creative, innovative people here, and now we're being completely silenced. We're being kicked off all kinds of sites. The latest one, I think, was Tumblr. So Tumblr getting rid of all nudity, all erotica, all sexuality. And you have an entire creative class, creative industry, area of workers who are just silenced and who now have to figure out how to pay using Bitcoin, have to use different peer-to-peer methods. And this is for something that, is legal in many cases.
Mm-hmm. You've laid out a bunch of options for us, like a buffet of here are all of the different things at our disposal. We can break them up. We can legislate. We can enforce the laws we already have. I'm not going to ask you to editorialize and say, here's the solution. And I take it as a complicated problem. We don't know what the solution is, and it might not be your role to proselytize for a solution. But you do study how this has worked around the world. What has been the most effective combination of these tools so far?
We're really in the early days. So even though there have been various rules around the world, we're still in the very early days of really effective policing. Because since the 1990s till about the early 2000s with 9/11, it was largely laissez-faire, right? It was largely governments doing hands-off, a lot of industry self-regulation, a lot of user regulation, right, community guidelines. So we're still in the early days of governments taking a stronger, more direct approach to regulation. But we can look to countries like Germany. So Germany's passed their social media regulation where companies have to take down violent hate speech within 24 hours. right? So this has been strongly criticized that 24 hours is, you know, maybe too short, that this may contribute to over-policing, mm-hmm. that contents that's satirical, news content, maybe documentaries might be taken down. And I think, you know, to take a serious look at laws like that. But before we can consider this kind of buffet of options, we really have to think carefully about how we regulate speech and to remember that all speech is regulated, right? We don't have unfettered speech here in Canada. We do have limits on speech. It's where we want those limits to be placed and who makes the rules. So what I really always come down to is who do we want those rules to be made by? I definitely want industry to be part of the conversation. But when Mark Zuckerberg spoke to the Washington Post and really said, we're ready to be regulated, I see that as very dangerous. Because that's a company setting out, these are the parameters around which we'll accept regulation. We're setting the narration of this is what regulation should look like. This is what we'll accept. I really want public, democratically elected, you know, accountable actors to have that conversation and then invite in industry, civil society, academics, lawyers, journalists, everybody.
I want to suggest to you that there's a better example than Germany. And it's one that I never thought was going to be a good example because in the early days covering this, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was this conception that you can't control this stuff, that the internet is made to be laissez-faire, it's made to be wild. We were wrong about that. There's a country that's been incredibly effective at coming up with a list of what is socially dangerous, what is socially acceptable, and then finding technological solutions to assert that. And that country, of course, is China.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a country where you cannot say a lot of things. You can't talk about Tibet. You can't look up Tiananmen Square. Now it's moved on to the social sphere. Everybody has a social credit number. And their comments online, they're doing a wonderful job of limiting types of harassment or bad behavior as the state sees it, because people have persistent identities, the scourge of anonymous trolling. Not the same there. Depends on what you want to do online. You can do all sorts of horrible things as a Chinese citizen online, but things that the state deems to be bad, people don't do because it follows you. That is the best example in the world so far of a country that is not fettered by very thorny questions of free expression, free speech, and freedom.
Yes, and China is the extreme authoritarian example. It's a non-democratic response. And so President Macron of France, when he spoke in November, he talked about different models of internet governance. And he put it really nicely. So he said we have a U.S. model. It's a very free speech model, commercial, profit-oriented model. We have China. It's a very authoritarian, state-involved model. But those aren't the only two models. And he posited that there can be another model, a third way. And so he talked about the European Union's involvement, where there's direct state involvement, but this would be based on human rights. So in direct contrast to a commercial, laissez-faire, free market approach and a very draconian, authoritarian Chinese approach. Facebook and Google are advertising-based. So if there is a dramatic change, say, in the European Union to advertising, that could be a huge hit to their business model. They're diversifying in other ways. But if you're looking at it as an economic investor, right, this is a massive risk to their business model. Now, is it likely that we're going to see a...
Wait, I don't understand. What is a massive risk to their business model?
If their advertising-based business model were put at risk, say if the European Union or the United States changed the way that they could offer ads, that they could target their users to offer these personalized ads, if Facebook and Google were no longer as attractive as digital advertising platforms, then their entire business model is in jeopardy. And that's really interesting because they are, you know, billion-dollar companies, but they're billion-dollar companies extremely focused on monetizing users' attention.
Rather than aiming regulation at the content itself, is there a way to try to improve things by regulating the ad business itself that Facebook and Google are so reliant on?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we see the general privacy regulation in the European Union, the GDPR, and there can be rules that say you can't collect this type of information on people. You can't store it. You can't identify people by their gender, by anything more specific than their postal code. You can't collect information on what you think people's political affiliation is.
Or that would be it for them, wouldn't it? I mean, that's their whole thing.
That is their whole thing. I mean, if we look at surveys, people are incredibly uncomfortable and they strongly oppose this type of targeted behavioral advertising. They want, of course, the free services, the email, the social networking, the search, but they don't want to pay with their personal data. So absolutely, we can pass rules. There would be a fierce objection to this. But if we look at the type of data that's being collected, this is what fuels the entire industry. If that were more strictly regulated, if you eliminate the granular level data that is collected, then absolutely you change the entire business model.
I mean, that is like a maximalist privacy protection regulation that you're suggesting there. That seems like it cuts to the heart of it. Right now they're saying, please regulate us because we just want to go back to doing business without being, you know, public enemy number one.
Yeah.
But this would be like destroying a business model that has reaped, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars for them and, you know, just destroyed my industry. But, you know, whatever, you could in just one fell swoop say, can't collect that data.
Yes, or you could say that people have to opt in, right? So if you're that person who wants...
Didn't we opt in?
Well, actually, it's everything set to public and you have to opt in to private. Uh-huh. And then, of course, our data has been collected in ways that we don't know about and we never consented to. And you know, even just this morning, Facebook's breach of 1.5 million emails that they, didn't mean to collect. But if we change this advertising-based business model, we could address the toxicity. We could address the exploitation of this surveillance-based economy.
That's interesting. I'm having trouble coming up with the argument as to why it's in the public's interest to have their data collected. And I mean, I guess it's better to have ads that are relevant to me than not, but it's not really that big a deal in my life.
I mean, if we're weighing, you know, the online toxicity and contributing to genocides versus finding the perfect pair of shoes, I'm much more interested in having better privacy.
I mean, this is sci-fi. It's never going to happen because there's billions and billions of, like, you know, this is exactly what they don't want to have happen. But I'll indulge some sci-fi for a minute. You know, it's some sort of alternate reality where, like, what if we just paid a couple bucks a month for Facebook as opposed to paying with our, you know, our privacy? And they'd have to figure out a different business model, and maybe it would just be pay for it.
We could pay for our social media consumption. We could pay for our search. We could pay for our email. I would, you know, gladly pay to have less harassment and hate speech and violence online. And I'd pay extra so that there could be some kind of free service for people who couldn't afford it or for youth. So I think switching to this, considering subscription models, thinking about different ways of restricting or outright outlawing advertising-based business models, that's where we start. So if we look at the underlying toxicity and problems with these business models, absolute surveillance, absolute data capture, algorithms that are designed to maximize engagement regardless of the content, even if it's the worst toxic content. If we look at that, then we can do a light touch regulation on the content.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me about it at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything you send. We are on Twitter @CanadaLand. Our website is canadalandshow.com. There's a new episode of Oppo this week. People, keep your eye on the ball with this coming election. Oppo is how you do that. This episode is produced by Kasia Mihailovich. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. If you like what we do here, if you want to receive ad-free versions of our podcasts, that is a perk that we offer to our Patreon supporters. Go to patreon.com/CanadaLand. We do rely on your support.